Now we offer some American history in three parts, sort of a biographical triptych, how three men of Europe, the Marquis de Lafayette, Cesare Beccaria, and Albert Einstein, influenced the United States from its founding to the nuclear age. The authors of new biographies about each of those men will be joining us over the next hour. Lafayette was the young French hero of the American Revolution. Beccaria was an Italian philosopher whose writings on crime and punishment influenced the U.S. Constitution. Albert Einstein was born 100 years later in Germany and became one of the world's greatest scientists who informed the American conscience on war and peace, racism, and civil rights. History in three parts, Lafayette, Beccaria, and Einstein, on Midday After the News. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. We offer some American history in this hour of the show. History in three parts, a sort of biographical triptych, how three men of Europe, the Marquis de Lafayette, Cesare Beccaria, and Albert Einstein, influenced the United States from its founding to the nuclear age. The least known of these is probably the man in the middle of our triptych, Beccaria. He was an Italian philosopher whose writings on crime and punishment greatly influenced the men who wrote the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. John Bessler, a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, wrote a book about Beccaria. John Bessler joins us today. Along with Stephen Gimbel, a professor and philosophy department chair at Gettysburg College, Stephen Gimbel, a Baltimore native, has a new book out about Albert Einstein, the German-born scientist who, in his years in the United States in the mid-20th century, had a lot to say about nuclear weapons, American society, and civil rights. Stephen Gimbel will be with us toward the end of the hour. But we start this three-part history hour with the Marquis de Lafayette, the young French hero of the American Revolution. In Baltimore's Mount Vernon Place, there is a statue of the Marquis on horseback, not far from Baltimore's Washington Monument, which honors the general Lafayette fought with during the Revolution. Similar statues of Gilbert de Motier, that's his, part of his full name, stand in other American cities and towns. Streets and schools are named after him. So how did this French aristocrat, 19 years old at the time, get involved in the American rebellion against British rule? And what did his own countrymen, who would see revolution in the streets of Paris a decade later, think of the Marquis de Lafayette? A few answers now from Laura Arricchio, author of a new biography, The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered, it's called. Laura Arricchio is Dean of Undergraduate Studies at the New School for Public Engagement in New York. Laura, welcome to the Midday Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did this happen? I guess I'll start with that question. A 19-year-old aristocrat from France, looking for adventure, didn't have enough to do.
Actually, sort of, yes. Lafayette was actually a fairly rustic young man. He came from the provinces of France, from the Auvergne region, and he had always dreamed that he would have a life in the military. But he actually ended up married into one of France's most distinguished families, and he found himself in Paris being expected to fit in at court. And he was really not cut out to be a courtier. He really wanted nothing more than military glory. And it just so happened that in 1776, in July, when a group of Americans came to Paris seeking arms and support for the American Revolution, Lafayette was one of the very many French noblemen who lined up to join the cause. Because, as you know, of course, France and England were long-standing rivals, and everyone in France, in high society, thought this was a terrific opportunity to get some revenge against the British.
I'm going to read his full name.
Okay.
I think it's Marie-Joseph Paul-Yves Roche Gilbert de Motier de Lafayette.
Yes.
How'd I do, Laura?
You did beautifully.
What did George Washington think when this young man from France showed up in the spring of 1777, 3 months short of his 20th birthday?
Well, you know, at first, George Washington was not entirely sure what to do with this young man. Lafayette, despite the fact that he had been given a rank of major general by Silas Deane, the American who was in Paris recruiting, Lafayette had actually never seen a day of battlefield action. And nonetheless, he arrived in America somehow expecting that he would be placed in command of a division. He was young, he was eager, he was enthusiastic, and he wanted to fight. And George Washington's initial reaction was actually a letter to Congress in which he said that there some confusion had arisen. He said, you know, the Marquis seems to believe that he should be placed in command, and I assumed his title was purely honorary. And Washington said, precisely what Congress wants me to do with him, I know no more than the child unborn.
So had the Marquis paid his way into the command of three brigades? I mean, what did Washington do?
Well, what eventually happened was that Washington believed, thanks to a letter from Benjamin Franklin, actually, Washington believed that all Lafayette really wanted was to have a small opportunity to earn himself some glory and then go home. And for this reason, Franklin recommended to Washington that he find an opportunity for Lafayette to participate in some battle that might be coming up, but in such a way that he would not be hazarded too much. And as it happened, such an opportunity seemed to be on the way. The British at this time were marching toward Philadelphia, and on September 11th was the Battle of Brandywine. Washington was expecting the British to attack in a certain area near a place called Chad's Ford, and therefore he stationed himself there, and he placed Lafayette on the battlefield but quite a distance away from where he expected the main attack to occur. Well, as it happened, the British fooled Washington, and Lafayette ended up in the middle of things and was actually wounded in the leg at the Battle of Brandywine. And Washington then inaugurated Lafayette's lasting American fame with a letter that he sent out to all the newspapers that said that Lafayette had been wounded in the leg. Lafayette, everybody expected to then go home. But Lafayette had other ideas, because he did not come here just for a little bit of glory. He came here to make a difference, and he came here because he wanted to learn and to help and to make a difference in the world. And so he stayed, and he proved to Washington, through his earnestness, through his enthusiasm, through his dedication, that he was here and ready to learn. And so Washington really was charmed by him, took him under his wing, and trained him into becoming a really magnificent military leader.
And I was only being partly facetious when I asked about the Marquis paying his way into the service. I'm assuming his family had money, but that wasn't part of this transaction.
No, it was not part of this transaction, but his money came in handy in one particular way, which is that although it's true that there are a lot of French nobility who were hoping to come to the United States to fight in the war before France became our official ally, most of them did not have as much money as he did, or if they did, they were beholden to parents who did not want them to leave. Lafayette, however, was an orphan, and he was an extraordinarily wealthy orphan. So that what he was able to do, which his friends were not, was he was able to actually purchase his own ship and come here at his own expense.
The word mythology is used in part to talk about when we talk about the Marquis de Lafayette, but he indeed was wounded, and Washington took him under his wing, even though he was much older than the Marquis. But there is something about this, right? That's sort of mythological, at least in American memory. It speaks to the alliance between France and the new country against Great Britain, obviously. But also this idea of the aristocrat coming to help the militia, the colonies, people struggling to be free.
Yes, you know, I think that it's I think that Lafayette in when he arrived in 1777 really represented something for the colonists here. Because coming as he did with the title of Marquis, all of a sudden it suddenly appeared to the Americans that old Europe, the old regime, might actually come to support the new world. Hmm. And this was something that was extremely important to the Americans at the time. So, in fact, the title of my book, The Marquis, it's called that because during the American Revolution, Lafayette was almost always referred to simply as the Marquis, as though there were no other Marquis, because he was the first Marquis to come here, not the only one. But when he did, the simple fact that somebody from that background would come to fight for our cause was something that really inspired people and gave them hope.
You know, after the war, what happened after the war? I guess first in terms of this country, the new country here, the states and their view of Lafayette. You heard me mention, Laura Riccio, you heard me mention that there's a grand statue of Lafayette in Mount Vernon Place in Baltimore. It's not far from Baltimore's Washington Monument. So the general hovers above the Marquis in that particular location. But there are other places where there are statues of the Marquis on the East Coast. Streets and schools are named after him. Did he sort of go on parade after the war, or did he stay in this country or immediately return to France?
So he immediately returned to France. He played a very important role in the Siege of Yorktown, the last major hostilities of the American Revolution. He went back to France, but in one crucial difference from many of the other Frenchmen who fought here, the other Frenchmen mostly went back to whatever careers they had left behind. Lafayette, however, had not left any career behind. He had been looking for a career when he came to America. And when he returned to France, he made America his career. He immediately defined himself as the new country's foremost ally in France. He negotiated favorable trade agreements. He had he made his home into a refuge for visiting Americans, the Jeffersons, the Adamses, the Franklins. They all came over for dinner. He had a gold engraved copy of the Declaration of Independence on his wall. He had American plants. He even brought a Native American young man back to live with him as a servant for a time. And eventually, in 1824-25, which was most likely when that statue was erected, he returned to the United States, which was gearing up to celebrate its 50th anniversary, because 1776, of course, would be the 50th anniversary. And he came in 1824-25, toured every one of the states in the Union. There were now 24 of them. And at that time, he was hailed far and wide as one of the last living and able-bodied links to the American founders. Hmm. And it was that at that time that statues, streets, colleges, schools, parks, and more were all named after him.
What did his countrymen think of him, especially when we get to the French Revolution? I know this this takes a while to explain. We don't have that much time. But I am curious, like, where did the Marquis fit into the streets of Paris during the Revolution of 1789?
Sure, I'll try to be brief. You know, as they say on Facebook, when you have your relationship update, it's complicated. I think that's the best way to describe Lafayette's relationship to his countrymen in the French Revolution. When the Bastille was stormed on July 14th, 1789, the French, the Parisians immediately turned to Lafayette. He had distinguished himself as the heir of Washington, as Washington's adopted son. And they believed that Lafayette might be the person who could lead them to a new era of liberty, just as Washington had led his country. They put Lafayette in charge of what became the French National Guard, and for a while, and they charged him with keeping the peace in Paris. The issue, though, was the problem he ran into was that Lafayette believed that what France needed was a reformed monarchy, not an abolished monarchy. He was opposed to the idea of instituting a republic in France. And he was equally opposed to maintaining the absolute monarchy they had. He thought that France needed a constitutional monarchy along the lines of England. Now, in 1789, this middle-of-the-road, moderate, reformist position was very, very common, actually. But as the revolution became more and more polarized and the each side dug its heels in, Lafayette, who was a man who always stuck to his principles, found himself standing pretty much alone on that middle ground. So that in 1792, a warrant went out for his arrest, he would almost surely have been executed. He was going to be arrested as an enemy of the revolution. Instead, he fled to Belgium, modern-day Belgium, and he was promptly arrested as an enemy of the king. So, in other words, he was seen as a traitor by the revolutionaries, and he was seen as a traitor by the monarchists.
He did live a good long time, though.
He sure did.
Yeah. Well, Laura, we'll have to get the book for the rest of that story, but thank you for giving us a taste of it today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
it's truly a pleasure.
Yeah. Laura Arricchio is a specialist in 18th century French history and art, and she is the Dean of Undergraduate Studies at the New School for Public Engagement in New York, where she spoke to us from. Her book is The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. Thank you again, Laura.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Our three-part Midday History Hour continues in just a moment. Up next, the Italian philosopher who greatly influenced the writers of the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. Please stay with us. And welcome back to Midday as we continue our biographical triptych now with a look at the life and scholarship of an Italian thinking man named Cesare Beccaria, or Cesare Beccaria. It depends on, where you're from and how you pronounce this name. I'm going to go for now with Cesare Beccaria was an Italian philosopher whose writings on crime and punishment greatly influenced the men who wrote the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. He knew a lot of them. John Bessler is here. John Bessler is a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's been on our show before. He just wrote a book about Beccaria. It's called The Birth of American Law, An Italian Philosopher, and the American Revolution. John Bessler, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
So how do you pronounce it?
Well, I've been to Italy recently, and I've heard that people pronounce it Cesare Beccaria, at least in Italy. But I think Italian names have wide variation of pronunciations in the United States. So
all right,
we'll give you a margin of appreciation on that pronunciation.
Okay. We'll just go with Beccaria or Beccaria during our talk here
today.
So, the point of your book is that a lot of people don't know about him and the influence he had on our founding laws in this country. So how did you get to him? I mean, you're a legal scholar. You've written several books. I'm guessing you got to him in your studies of the death penalty, perhaps?
Yes, he was the first Enlightenment writer to write against the death penalty. But you'll notice that the book title itself does not mention his name, and that's actually intentional because people don't know who he is, and so nobody would really pick up a book about somebody that they don't know who they are.
Do law students hear about him?
He's really, I think because of the title of his book, he wrote a book in Italian in 1764 called Die Delitte e del Pene, which was translated into English in 1767 as On Crimes and Punishments. And I think because of the title of the book, people always assume that this book was only about crimes and punishments. And actually, there's a larger story there. But because of the title of his book, I think it's the book is really read mostly now in criminal justice courses, undergraduate criminal justice courses. There's a few legal historians might know who this is, but he's very rarely studied it even in law schools. And even though he had a huge influence on the founding era.
Was Beccaria a nobleman?
Yes, he was. He was the eldest son of a noble family in Milan. Not as wealthy as Lafayette, but he was he's known as the Marquis Beccaria in the United States and in Europe. So that's the title that you see associated with his name.
Okay. So
he never came to the U.S., actually, but he had a huge influence on the U.S.
So he had time to think about things because he was from a noble family. Maybe not quite as wealthy as the Lafayettes in France, but he had time to think about this.
He did, and actually he was also a very young man. When he wrote this book, when it was first published, he was only 26 years old. For all those listeners out there who are still, young, get moving and start working on something.
Well, make your case for us, Counselor. How did he influence, let's start with the Declaration of Independence and the men who wrote that.
Yes. So in the, but this book came out at a really important time. So the book came out, as I mentioned, in 1764. Several of the founders actually read or spoke Italian to one degree or another. Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, Adams, John Quincy Adams, all had some Italian. And so some of the founders actually read this book in the original Italian. But it was translated, as I said, in 1767 into English, and so it had a very wide influence by that point. And one of the things that the book talked about was actually this idea of happiness. Beccaria was actually an economist who was influenced by a man named Pietro Verri, who was about 10 years older than he was, who was also an economist, who wrote a book called Meditations on Happiness. And in 1774, the Continental Congress as an entire body actually quotes Beccaria. So, and they say that this is the words that they quoted from his book. In every human society, says the celebrated Marquis Beccaria, there is an effort continually tending to confer on one part the height of power and happiness, and to reduce the other to the extreme of weakness and misery. The intent of good laws is to oppose this effort and to diffuse their influence universally and equally. So he wrote about happiness, as his mentor Pietro Verri did, and he was based in Milan. And this idea and his book also opposed tyrannical practices. And this book really struck a nerve then at the time of the Revolutionary War kicks in. This quote from the Continental Congress is coming in 1774, just a year before the Revolutionary War starts. And so he really played a seminal role in inspiring their efforts to oppose tyranny. They felt that the Americans felt like they were being treated like slaves. They weren't being, the idea of taxation without representation, they didn't feel like they were being treated fairly by the British. And so when this book came out and opposed tyrannical practices, it really touched a nerve in the colonies.
So Beccaria got them thinking about the pursuit of happiness as being one of the reasons why you have a civilized society and live free?
Yeah, in his book was first translated into French shortly after it was published, and then it was translated in English. And Jeremy Bentham, who was somebody who was a very famous penal reformer, a lot of people know his name, he said that when Beccaria's work appeared, Beccaria was received by the intelligent as an angel would be by the faithful. And the book, essentially, on crimes and punishments, Beccaria's book, argued for proportion between crimes and punishments. It argued against the death penalty. It argued that the certainty of punishment was more important than the severity of punishment. And it also talked about this idea of happiness, which was, again, resonated with the colonists.
John Bessler is our guest in this segment of the Midday Show. His latest book is The Birth of American Law, An Italian Philosopher and the American Revolution, taking a look at the influence of Cesare Beccaria, or Cesare Beccaria, whatever you like, in his influence on the founders. So tell me this, John. See if you can handle this question. I think you can. Which way could this have gone? When the founders were looking at the law, and they were thinking, well, we're going to have that constitutional government. We have to have a foundation in law, a country of laws and not of men, right? And we're not going to be ruled by a king. When they were looking at all that, it could have gone either way, right? Because their background was influenced by England. What they saw in terms of law came from England,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So here's your Italian guy saying, no, you got to look at this a different way now. In what way was he asking them to look at it differently?
Well, his book also talked about how you want to have clear and precise laws and written laws. And the idea of the civil law, actually, it was a continental European concept, was that you need to publish the laws and let people know what the laws are. The English system was built on the common law system, and it involved a lot of discretion of the judges. And the judges sometimes did different things on different days.
Some might say whim.
On a whim, right. A caprice, right? Exactly. Arbitrary.
Yeah.
So the whole idea that Beccaria proposed was that you publish the laws, let people know what the laws are, and then people know how to follow the laws. And so that was something that was very appealing. And actually, Adams in the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, which is the oldest continuously operating constitution, speaks of a government of laws, not of men. And so this idea of the civil law and the civil code, things like the Justinian Code, they were looking to Rome for examples, and they were trying to figure out why it was that the Roman Republic didn't last. They were trying to create a new form of government in the United States, and actually they're fighting Great Britain, so you wouldn't expect them to adopt what Great Britain did, right?
Right, I guess not. But that was their main influence, right?
Yeah.
That's what, in terms of law and the courts and all that, right?
Yeah,
civil law, criminal law.
Yeah, a lot of the words were borrowed from English law,
yeah.
But a lot of the impetus came from the French Enlightenment, the Italian Enlightenment. The other writer that was very influential, actually influenced Beccaria, was Montesquieu, who wrote a book called The Spirit of the Laws, and that was published in 1748. And that was basically a description of the laws throughout Europe. But it was more descriptive. Beccaria's was more arguing this is what the law ought to be. And that was a big difference.
How about the phrase equal justice under the law? Was that his phrase, or did his writing speak to that idea?
It spoke to the idea of equality and the idea that nobles should not be punished differently than people that were not of noble heritage. And so that was a pretty radical idea back then. There was the punishments were different for people that were aristocratic. They might be private punishments. They might be, imprisoned in secret in a tower somewhere, whereas the commoners, so-called, would be, publicly punished with the pillory or some other, kind of a barbarous kind of punishment.
Speaking of barbarous punishment, the death penalty. Okay, let's talk about that. Beccaria on the death penalty. Did he feel it? Shouldn't exist at all. It should never be used.
Yeah, the only Beccaria argued, and again, he was arguing from trying to inject rationality into the idea of punishment. So he thought, and he was very fascinated by math, actually. So he thought that there should be a scale of punishments, and there should be a corresponding scale of penalties for those crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So scale of crimes and punishments. And he was opposed to the death penalty. The only narrow exception that he could envision was if somebody who was incarcerated could, from prison, potentially still overthrow the government. And so that was something that he carved out as a narrow exception. And actually, in Maryland, interestingly, there is actually a clause in the Maryland Constitution of 1776 called the Sanguinary Laws Clause.
Sanguinary meaning death penalty.
It's a synonym for bloody or cruel.
Yeah, okay.
If you look at the early American dictionaries, and so the Sanguinary Laws Clause, which is still there, actually talks about how sanguinary laws ought to be avoided, except as is consistent with the safety of the state. And so one interpretation of that would be to say that they were worried when they put those laws in place in Maryland that there could be revolutions that could overthrow the government.
And that actually overthrow the state government.
Sure. And that was at that point, that was a serious concern, right? Back at the early days of the founding, there was a lot of chaos in those days.
And that's in our Constitution.
That's in the Maryland Constitution.
And have attorneys for death penalty or death row inmates ever argued?
They have argued that based on that clause. But of course, now the Maryland has abolished the death penalty. So,
did Beccaria speak to the right to bear arms?
He did. He also spoke to that. And I guess a summary of his position: he didn't think there should be any regulation of arms. And actually, there's a lot of people. Different influences who influenced the founders, but I've heard it summarized: if you outlaw guns, only outlaws will have guns. That's kind of the summary of his position. Now, he didn't live in an age where, we see these kind of workplace shootings. We see a lot of the weapons getting more and more lethal over time. But that was also an area in which Thomas Jefferson actually copied into his commonplace in the original Italian. He copied Beccaria's thoughts on not having regulation of guns. So that also can explain a little bit about the Second Amendment, I think, as well.
So it's very clear his influence on the Bill of Rights and the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Even though he never visited this country, it's there.
Yes, it's definitely there in the Bill of Rights. This idea of opposing cruelty gets repeated again and again by many founders. James Wilson, James Madison said that he would be open to an experiment of abolishing the death penalty by any state willing to make that experiment. Thomas Jefferson, in his autobiography in the 1820s, actually said that Beccaria had convinced the reasonable world of the inefficacy and unrightfulness of the punishment of crimes by death. So these are key founders that are reading his book. And I found that there was definitely influence on the first American presidents. George Washington refers to making punishment more proportionate. He actually said that capital punishment and torture, which Beccaria also wrote against, Washington said was disagreeable to our natures. And Jefferson, as I mentioned, copied a number of different passages into his commonplace book. We've already talked about the one about the gun ownership, but he copied more than 24 passages in the original Italian into his commonplace book, which is how lawyers studied in that time.
And yet the death penalty was used in almost all the states, I think, right, at one point.
Yeah, the these ideas were seen as, and Beccaria was called a philosophical legislator. These ideas were novel ideas, and you see references in the founding era to the a state making the Beccarian experiment. So they were trying to experiment with making punishments milder, and his writings and the idea of putting people in prison instead of executing them led to the creation of the penitentiary system. But of course, the penitentiary system was not fully built out until most of the founders had already died. I think the last founder died in the signer of Declaration of Independence died in the 1830s. It was actually from Maryland, actually the founder that died. But Beccaria was writing in the 1760s, and we of course hear about de Tocqueville.
Touring the United States in the
1830s, but there was actually someone that was in Beccaria's social circle. His name was Luigi Cascaglione, another Italian, who came over. He went to all 13 of the original states, and he came here in the 1780s, right before the Constitutional Convention. And you see that after he came here, first of all, he noted it. He wrote he was a botanist. So
he was a botanist.
He mostly wrote about plants and some social customs. But he wrote a travelogue called The Viaggio, which was published in Italy after he went back around the 1790 period. It was only translated into English in 1983. And in that book, we find a letter from William Bradford, who was one of James Madison's closest friends. And he describes how important Beccaria was in the New World, and that Bradford, who became the second Attorney General of the United States, said that Beccaria's works were common among lettered persons in Pennsylvania, and he's writing this letter to this botanist who was visiting Philadelphia at the time.
Did he get into actual criminal procedure, the handling of cases, prosecution of cases and all that, the infrastructure, so to speak, of the legal system?
Well, he opposed torture. And, of course, in continental Europe, one of the criminal procedures that was used was torture. Now, the English had a different approach to torture. And under English law, the commentators in English law would always laud the fact that they did not torture people. Of course, now, if you go to the Tower of London, we know that they did, from time to time, torture people, but the civil law system was a lot different than the system in England. He did write about a number of different areas. One of the things he advocated for was trial by juries, but of course that was also an issue that was important in England as well. So there was some concurrence of ideas from Beccaria and from the traditional English sources, but he definitely affected a change in the way that the Americans looked at ideas like cruelty.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that holds up, doesn't it?
Yeah, people...
We're seeing abolition of the death penalty in more and more states.
So, as
one example.
Yeah, I mean, last year was the 250th anniversary of the publication of this book in the Italian, the original Italian, this Di Delitto ed il Pene that I talked about. And actually, in Europe, if you go to Milan, there's an entire square still named after Beccaria. You will find, if you go to Rome, there's and walk through the gardens there in Rome, you'll find a bust of Beccaria. There's a street named after him in Paris, and so he's still very well known in Europe. But you might ask yourself, well, why is it that he's not so well known in the United States? And that's an interesting question. I think that the main reason that he's not so well known in the United States anymore is because his name does not get mentioned in the Federalist Papers. And why is that? Well, because of the fact that the Federalist Papers were intended just for a New York audience to ratify the Constitution of New York, and the federal Constitution was focused on the structure of government. Crime and punishment was a state law issue back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so his name, some of the ideas from his book show up in the Federalist Papers, but not his name.
Not his name.
And Montesquieu's name shows up in four different Federalist Papers, and one, his name is mentioned five times. So when school kids read about the founding era, they hear about Montesquieu, but not Beccaria.
Cesare Beccaria, or Cesare Beccaria, whatever you like. Now more people know about him because of John Bessler's book, The Birth of American Law, An Italian Philosopher and the American Revolution. I didn't know who your publisher was on. I didn't notice.
Yeah, it's a Carolina Academic Press.
Very good, John. John Bessler, who teaches law at the University of Baltimore Law School. How many books does this make for you now? Five?
This is number six.
Number six. Way to go, John. Thank you very much for being here.
You bet. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
John Bessler. Another short break on midday, and our three-part history hour continues with a leap in time. 100 years after the Constitution was written, Albert Einstein was born in Germany. Stephen Gimbel of Gettysburg College has written a new book about the great scientist. And when we get back, we'll hear about Einstein's years in the United States. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. And now for the last piece of our three-part Midday History Hour, Albert Einstein, the great German-born physicist whose general theory of relativity became the foundation of modern physics. We look in this segment of the show at Einstein's years in the United States and what he had to say not only about science, space, and time, but about American society and civil rights and the nuclear arms race. Stephen Gimbel is a professor and philosophy department chair at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. He lives in Mount Airy, Maryland. He grew up in Baltimore. Einstein, His Space and Time, is Stephen Gimbel's second book on the scientist. Einstein's Jewish Science, Physics at the Intersection of Politics and Religion, was published in 2012 by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And Stephen Gimbel's new book is forthcoming from Yale University Press in their Jewish Lives series. Steve Gimbel, welcome to Midday. It's nice to have you on the show.
It's wonderful to be with you.
It sounds like you've had an almost lifelong fascination with Albert Einstein.
Well, you can't be a sort of Jewish nerd growing up in this country and not love Einstein.
Steve grew up in Baltimore. You attended UMBC and Johns Hopkins as well. And all through that, a fascination with Einstein. In this part of the show, I was very interested in his, what we might call his American years or his U.S. years, based at Princeton. And what I found most interesting is that Einstein had a lot to say about a lot of things, specifically how humans related to each other, about society, about racism, about human rights. And he did this most of his life.
He did. Well, he of course grew up in Germany, you know, as a Jew, and that really sort of was formative in a way that remained so his whole life. So when he had to flee Germany, you know, because of the rise of Hitler, and he ended up coming ultimately to the United States, there was a whole wave of intellectuals that came over, you know, musicians, authors, scientists, mathematicians, philosophers. Many of them, when they got here, though, felt as if they needed to hold their tongue because, really, they were visitors in a new country. Einstein, on the other hand, was a worldwide celebrity, and so he used that celebrity to be able to say things that other people might not have been able to get away with.
I was struck by, in reading about him, about his years, was after World War II, I think. He became an American citizen, actually, 1940, I think. Is that right, Steve?
Yes.
Yeah, he joined the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People while he was in Princeton and campaigned for the civil rights of African Americans.
He did. Princeton, you know, while it's in the north, in New Jersey, it actually was one of those towns that was much more southern in nature, and it was a very segregated town when Einstein lived there. And he never drove, so he walked everywhere. And as he walked home, he would make it a point to walk through the African-American neighborhood, something which was unusual to see a white man walking through those neighborhoods. And he became really good friends with the people there. He would sit on the porches. There was one girl with whom he'd work on her math homework, and she'd pay him in gumdrops. And he saw in the African-American community something reminiscent of what he felt in the Jewish communities back in Germany. So in a certain sense, it felt more like home to be amongst the minority, even in his new home country.
Also a pacifist. And when we get to the end of World War II, and he saw the way the, his theories had been put to use in a war, how did he react to that?
Well, he was a pacifist. He thought that war was an abomination and was just a plague on humanity. But he grew up in Germany, where the militarism before World War I, during, after, and in the rise of Hitler just concerned him deeply. And so really there were two instances at this point where he makes what seem like strange moves for a pacifist. One is when he fled Germany, he actually ended up in Belgium for a short while before coming to the United States. And in Belgium, there was, you know, an imminent threat from the Nazis who were about to invade, and a prominent citizen declared himself a pacifist and refused to fight. And the king and queen of Belgium, with whom Einstein had become fairly close, were worried that this might catch on and that the country would be in existential peril.
Mm-hmm.
So they begged Einstein not to make his cause one of Einstein's causes. And Einstein did say that, look, all things being equal, war should never be used as an implement of foreign policy, but when it's a matter of saving lives against barbarians invading, you need to protect yourself.
Hmm.
That principle held in place when he came to America. He was working at Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study, and one summer he decided to take a vacation. He was out up in New York State when he suddenly gets a visit from an old friend, a colleague of his, another physicist named Leo Szilard. Now, the theory of relativity, right, the very most famous aspect is the equation E equals mc squared, right, which says that from a tiny bit of mass, you can extract a huge amount of energy. Now, of course, this could be used, you know, for peaceful means, right, or it could be weaponized. But the means of getting energy out of mass, the scientists at the time thought couldn't be done. So no one was terribly worried about nuclear weapons. And then his friend Leo Szilard, when he was in London, sitting at a traffic light, suddenly realized how it could be done. It involved radioactivity, and did a few calculations, realized uranium would be the stuff. So he realized, where was the uranium? Well, in the Congo, right? If you think back to the Gulf War, there was all this, you know, talk about yellow cake uranium.
Right.
Right? That was the stuff. So Szilard realized, we need to keep Germany from getting its hands on this uranium. But the Congo at the time was a Belgian colony. So he thought, well, Einstein's connected to the royal family in Belgium. I can go through Einstein, and he'll tell them, make sure you don't sell uranium to the Germans, because no one else knew this would be the use. So Szilard and another colleague, Eugene Wigner, find Einstein on vacation, show up unexpected on his doorstep. He invites them in. They sit out on the porch, and Szilard explains what he's realized. He's come up with the idea of a nuclear chain reaction and how it could be turned into a weapon. So immediately Einstein realizes an atomic bomb with Hitler would be a very bad idea. And so they decide they need to get to the king and queen of Belgium, but they're all foreigners during a war. Sending a communication to, you know, heads of state might look suspect, especially since Einstein, as a pacifist, right, was looked on skeptically. So they thought, well, maybe we should go through the American government first. And then the idea was, well, maybe we ought to go right to the American government. And they decided to write a letter to Roosevelt.
And that's what got us to the Manhattan Project, right?
Exactly.
I want to, Stephen, take a moment here and read just from the introduction of Einstein, his Space and Times, which is due out in April. At the time, he felt he had no other choice but to sign that letter urging the creation of this Manhattan Project. But after hearing of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima, Einstein is reputed to have said that he could burn his fingers for having signed that letter. Like the physical world, the political realm curved in strange and unexpected ways. It was relativity that led Einstein out of the patent office to become a college professor. It was relativity that made Einstein famous. It was relativity that was condemned by the Nazis for being, quote, Jewish science. It was relativity that allowed him the political voice to oppose them. It was relativity that led to the possibility of atomic weapons and Nazi dominance. It was relativity that gave Einstein the standing to do something to stop it. It was relativity that made Einstein, Einstein. Albert Einstein was a cause and an effect of history, a product of both his space and his times. That's just the introduction of Stephen Kimball's latest book on Einstein, his Space and Times. It's part of the Jewish Lives series from Yale University Press. And so in the United States and after the war, and we get to the 1950s, and he's actually urging an end to the use of nuclear weapons, right? He signs a letter with Bertrand Russell what, a month or two before he dies, I think.
Yeah. One of the great ironies, that letter, the famous letter sent to Roosevelt, mm-hmm. Szilard came back out a second time for them to write the letter. And the friend of theirs who drove him the first time was out of town, so he brought another physicist, Edward Teller, who took dictation from Einstein, who originally dictated the letter in German, then they translated it into English. Teller, of course, would go on to become the father of the hydrogen bomb.
Right.
And so this one act, which began the nuclear age, also led to this escalation that Einstein felt deeply, deeply concerned with and spoke out, very loudly at a time when it wasn't necessarily politically expedient to do so.
Hey, Steve, we only have a few minutes left here, a couple minutes left. So everybody always says Einstein, genius. Of course, the name is synonymous with genius. Is it amazing to you, even though you've spent your life thinking about him and reading about him, researching him, how much he did, not just in terms of science and physics, how much he had to say about things, how he was just always thinking and expressing himself?
He was, ever since he was young, he considered himself a citizen of the world, right? He left Germany at 16. He was left behind by his parents to finish high school, and unaccompanied, he left Germany and made his way to Italy and renounced his citizenship. He, from the very beginning of his adulthood, always had this strong sense of justice, this desire to oppose injustice and power where it was used inappropriately. And so even though he does focus so much on his physics, he really did see himself as a citizen of the world.
Wouldn't you love to have a cup of coffee with him?
Oh, without a doubt.
Well, your introduction and the early chapters here makes me want to finish reading this book. It's out in April, though. We're a little bit ahead of the time here. Steve Kimball had an earlier book on Einstein that was just published a couple of years ago by the Johns Hopkins University Press. That was Einstein's Jewish Science, Physics at the Intersection of Politics and Religion. Now, this new one from Yale is Einstein, His Space and Time, part of Yale University Press's Jewish Lives series. So, Steve, thank you very much. And maybe in April, when the book is actually out, come and spend an hour with us here at Midday, would you?
We'd be absolutely delighted.
Okay, that'd be great. Stephen Kimball, who is a professor and a philosophy department chair at Gettysburg College. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And I thank you, everybody, who listened to our show today. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed our program, our second hour, a history triptych, I call it, the stories of three European men and how they influenced the United States from its founding to the nuclear age. For everybody here on our staff, including Chuck Ferndale, I want to thank him for contributing to the second hour of the show, providing some notes on our program. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I hope you have a great weekend, and see you back here for the next Midday.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richmond, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Rogic's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.